From Canada Land, this is The Imposter, and I'm Aaliyah Pabani. On this episode...
Oh, you do this and this and this. What don't you do?
I'll cut my lips and I'll bleed a little bit.
I was in my bedroom dancing, reading, and masturbating.
Hi, I'm Darcy Spidle from West Chiswick, Nova Scotia, and I play the jaw harp. The jaw harp's a very internal instrument, so when you're playing, it's your mouth and your lungs and your throat and your tongue and your breath that's creating all the sound. The harp itself doesn't really make much sound. And so while you're playing, it's a very rich listening experience to the performer, but just sticking a mic in front of my mouth wasn't necessarily capturing all that texture. So I started playing around with different ideas on how to amplify the inside of my body. I started with a contact mic and I tried to record it through my heart. I tried to swallow a contact mic and record, and eventually I just settled on a throat mic. So I'd press the contact mic sort of into the side of my windpipe, this sweet spot I found where there was lots of bass, and I'd strap this homemade collar on, and just the tighter I'd pull that strap, the more sounds I'd get out of my throat, so which became a bit of a problem. I'd be a little woozy while I was recording these songs. But, you know, I was very happy with the results. There's a lot of bass in your throat. So this album sort of emerged from that process. I'd use an external mic as well, and I put like a banker's clip on the harp and some chains and
what's a banker's clip?
Well, it's like a roach clip. I don't know. Like it's
okay.
Just
oh yeah, yeah.
The
okay,
proper
gotcha.
Term, you know, which I had to look up before I started talking about it. But yeah,
yeah, so, you wanted to call it a roach clip.
That's right. So I just control that with my hand, and I do some vocalizations, and I start to hear these things in my throat, just sounds I'd never heard before, little gasps and tissue separating, and it was quite an experience, a very disembodied type experience. So I did that for a couple weeks, just recorded probably 500 tracks. Like Malform does sound quite affected, but there are no effects. I mean, the contact mic sounds a bit distorted because of basically the friction of it rubbing against the skin and some whisker on my neck. And so you hear like a record scratching sound, and that's just the mic and just wind in my throat, air. So yeah, there's no effects, which is just sort of something I think is interesting to do. And everybody seems to think it's affected, but no, it isn't. I've played in a lot of different projects over the years. I've done noise music and played in punk bands. And about 7 years ago, I moved out to the country from the city. And someone gave me a jaw harp for my birthday, and I started looking into the history of it. And I ordered a few from sort of artisan blacksmiths from around the world, and I just started hiking with them. So it was a very sort of nature-based practice. I would just hike, and I'd play jaw harp, and I'd record the ocean, and it was sort of I was just sort of journaling these experiences. And then over the years, it's moved more into this sort of experimental territory. I recorded this album in June, last June, and that winter I'd been working on vocalizations a lot. I used to be this sort of this crust punk singer, and I damaged my voice in some pretty serious ways over the years. So I was trying to explore some of that damage, just, you know, listening to my voice and kind of vocalizing in ways that were a bit sick sounding, maybe.
I was interested when you kind of talked about how this project maybe had its origins in kind of walks you were taking with the harp, because I wanted to know about the connection between kind of that being in your body but out in the natural world, I guess, and how that connects to this work that is essentially very internalized or very based in your body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe some of it does go to meditation and the idea of you know, being an individual, but also being part of, you know, a greater thing, being one with everything. Maybe it sounds flaky, but I just living in the country and spending a lot of time alone in these natural settings. I don't know. I guess it does something to my mental state. You know, there's just this small little instrument, this puny little person, you know, walking. I walk along these cliffs where the ocean is just taking these trees. You walk the 100-foot cliffs and just, you know, these 30-foot trees pointed straight down into the ocean. You know, that's where I usually hike, and I do a lot of recording there. And I don't know, there's something just so powerful about that, and something so small about myself in that moment, and the sounds I'm making with this little instrument. I feel that nature is a pretty big influence, and you will hear quite a bit of field recording on these albums. Some of my older albums are recorded on the shore, so you'll hear waves, and I try to improvise with those sounds. I have a new album coming out that I recorded in the Bay of Fundy, where I just built a raft of driftwood that I found laying around there, and strung it with some fishing line and clam shells, and just sailed around playing jaw harp in the bay. So yeah, I don't know what the connection is, but I feel that it's strong.
Well, I would like to suggest something just from my my listening, is that by recording the body as the kind of movement of sound or wind, or, you know, the kind of viscera of your body pumping this sound out, mm-hmm. It kind of, to me, evokes nature. It connects the body to a natural setting where those pulsations and forces are always kind of acting on the environment.
Absolutely.
It's almost like you're doing a field recording of your body to
me. Wow, that's an amazing way to put it. Yeah, no, I hear you. And with the throat mic in particular, there were all these sounds. It was just such a rich environment of sound that I'd never heard before, you know. So I'd be listening to myself and hearing these sounds that were just completely foreign to me, and they're inside my body and they're vast, and it's just all flesh and tissue, just like everything else outside, you know. It was a fairly powerful experience, but yeah, I love that what you just said. That's great. Once I got the throat mic in the mix, I did just this year started playing live with it. The performance is quite visceral. You know, I usually cut myself pretty bad when I'm playing. I just get carried away. And some of the Russian harps I have, they're kind of like blades. So I've always been a performer like that, where I sort of leave some skin on the stage or whatever. And I don't know why it is, but I'll cut my lips and I'll bleed a little bit.
This episode of The Imposter is brought to you by Zipcar. Owning a car is kind of like owning an umbrella. It's extremely convenient until that moment it breaks in a thunderstorm, or until you have to drag its flaccid, wet carcass around with you all day. When I was in Japan a few years ago, I noticed there was a rack full of umbrellas inside like every institution. And that's because in Japan, umbrellas are the currency in a massive sharing economy. People don't really own umbrellas, they just pick them up at the place they're leaving and then drop them off at whatever place they're going. With Zipcar, driving a car is like using an umbrella in Japan. Zipcars are parked in reserved parking spaces and garages within walking distance of where their members live and work. And Zipcar members can book a car on the Zipcar app and then use their Zip card to unlock the car. And then they can just drive away. If you sign up for Zipcar right now, you'll get $25 of free driving credit. To do that, just go to joinzipcar.com/theimposter and you'll be helping out the show. Again, that's joinzipcar.com/theimposter.
If I am judged, if I am punished, if I am dismissed, if I am misunderstood, if I am celebrated, if I am envied, if I am competed with, if I am slandered against, if I am seen, if I am soft, if I am stupid, if I get it, if I surpass, if I intimidate, if I confound, if I confuse, if I'm confused, if I impress, if I delight, if I contradict, if I embarrass, if I'm transparent, if I'm arrogant, if I reproach, if I lamb, if I snake, if I coconut, if I'm crazy, if I'm cuckoo, if I'm weary, if I resist, if I'm easy, if I'm wrong, if I'm wrong, who gives a fuck? I have to live.
A couple of years ago, a friend told me about seeing Aisha Sasha John do a reading of her second book of poetry, Thou, at the gala for the Trillium Book Awards. It was in this kind of stuffy, carpeted boardroom in the Toronto Reference Library. The room was packed with mostly older literary types, and the CBC host calls Aisha on stage to read. So Aisha goes up and says something like, "This is for my ancestors," and then pours a glass of water onto the carpeted stage. My friend said that people were kind of dumbfounded, like they didn't know whether they should be gasping or laughing. Do you remember that?
I pour libations for ancestors before I read, so I don't remember. But that surprised her. Like, what was the...
I think she was used to people reading the book.
Yeah.
And I think for her, there was something else that was created in the space of you performing your work that she hadn't seen.
Hmm.
As much, you know, like there are people who are good readers, but then I feel like you are a performer, you know, it's not just about reading the words.
I now understand that to be a compliment, but for many years I was like very sort of like I couldn't deal with that, hearing that, because I the response that I got as a Black woman in Toronto poetry scenes was like, "Oh, you're a poet, so you do spoken word." Like, I was like, it was always assumed that I was a spoken word artist,
right?
And sort of like my talent for performing was always used against me. I know you're not using it against me now, but it was always used to like undermine me,
right? And what you do is different than what poets do, or something,
or more like, who are the famous Black people that we know? Actors, musicians, performers, and athletes, right? And so we're talking about like white people who their experience of Blackness is through performers and athletes. And so the fact that I was a good performer, like I wasn't even being congratulated about it, like as if it was a talent to have or like a skill that I've worked on or like how much money have I spent on fucking workshops. Do you know what I mean? Like, whatever. I'm not saying I didn't have talent, but like, I have worked on it. Like, it was always just taken for granted. And I always resented that. I was always resented that it wasn't seen as work or something. Mm-hmm. Or just, like, I understood what's valued in the culture. And I understood that even as I was being congratulated, it was, like, underhanded or something. And so, like, I took in all of that. And I haven't even completely sweated out. Like, I'm sure when I listen to this, I'll be like, oh, like, why do you care so much? But, like, I feel like, you know, that's what I mean. And, like, the work for me is loving myself so that I can celebrate in the wealth that I have, no matter where I got it, whether it's a product of coming from a family of fantastic storytellers, you know, like, because that's probably closer to it, you know. And, like, if that's my heritage, then I can celebrate in that wealth.
Pussy pain. Bike crash. Mid-30s. Adolescent. Monday morning. I look at the shore. I'm sheepish and lost. I am so tired at the shore. Jesus is waiting.
I had wanted to talk to Aisha for a long time, because she has this way of moving kind of seamlessly between the physical and the verbal. Things that we tend to think about as separate. Like, she's a dancer and a writer and a singer and a performer, but there's a kind of fluidity that none of those terms seem to fully capture.
I understand myself now as a singing dancer. I'm a singing dancer. Like, when I came up with that, I was like, oh my God, like, yes. Like, anytime somebody asked me for a bio, I was like, Jesus, Lord, help me. Like, what am I going to say? How am I going to fucking, like...
Do they think you're, like, in musical theater?
I mean, I am.
Okay.
In the sense that, like, 10 years ago when I was studying clown, I did this character named Cindy Campbell.
Wait, you studied clown? What does that mean?
You know, like, physical theater, like...
Okay.
Yeah. And so...
Wait, can you just describe really quickly what that involves? I don't know.
There are a lot of, like, actors and comedians and, like, sketch comedy that you are familiar with that, like, is clown, but most people aren't, you know, when they think of clown, they think of, like, a red nose and whatnot, right. But it's a form.
I think of John Wayne Gacy, but...
Yeah, so it's, like, not everybody does clown with a nose on.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a form...
It's like physical comedy.
Exactly, right. Exactly. So I had this character that I developed in a clown workshop called Cindy Campbell. And Cindy Campbell got her name from... it was a hybrid of Naomi Campbell and Cindy Crawford, because I grew up in the 90s and supermodels were really big. So she was a quadruple threat. She was a singer, actor, dancer, writer, and she had a lisp. Hi, my name is Cindy Campbell. And she was like 17, very precocious, very talented. And In the piece, I danced to Madonna and sang, and I wore a leotard, and I did this like Cockney accent. I did this like monologue with like a whole bunch of accents that just like went everywhere. And it was well received, but I actually had to stop doing it because, like, I would be getting big laughs and I wasn't really sure what people were laughing at. Like, I didn't feel control over what was being laughed at. And then when I saw the video, I was like, oh, they're laughing at my tits because I'm like, my tits are shaking. And that was like, whoa. And then also I realized that the piece was me caricaturizing myself in a way that I thought was like problematic, where the fact that I'm multi-talented is something that has been like a threat to people, and I've been sort of like bugged about it, like, oh, you do this and this and this, what don't you do? Like, and so I think that sort of like, oh, I'm not serious, oh, I do too many things, oh, like that anxiety of like doing a lot of things was what I was like working through in a way in the piece, but I was making fun of her. And I was like, I think there's something fucked up about the fact that it's funny. Also, being a black woman in the clown community is like all white, you know. So here I am and it's funny that there's like a young, talented black woman. Like, I thought it was fucked up.
He thinks I should be glad because they like the idea of Aisha. I am not the idea of Aisha. I am Aisha. You, I know you love the idea of Aisha. I am not the idea of Aisha. I am not the idea of Aisha. I am Aisha.
I had a really strict father, and I went to school in Vancouver, but I lived in the suburbs because I was there for this program. Truly, like, throughout my adolescence, like, I spent hours a day dancing. That's what I did. Like, my parents couldn't afford dance school, like, beyond, like, age, like, 13, I think I stopped. And I wasn't allowed to talk on the phone. I had no friends in Coquitlam. I was, like, very isolated. I'm a very gregarious person. I had all this energy, and I had, like, I was allowed to watch TV, talk on the phone. Like, I was in my bedroom dancing, reading, and masturbating. Like, I just, like, had my own private world for years and years and years and years and years. It's, like, it's just, like, always been that way. I left my dance group when I was 27, and I went to grad school for writing. And at the time, I was in a group when we did, like, various types of Ethiopian and Congolese dance. And I certainly didn't have the ability, nor was there a market for me to be a solo dancer of in those forms. So I just thought it was over for me. I was like, okay. And I took this improvising dance class based on the recommendation of a friend who was raving about it. I was 31. And, you know, in terms of the traditions that I had danced in, like, I was always best as a freestyler. I was always best as an improviser. I'm very slow at getting choreography. Fuck, so slow. And and so I was like, oh, I was like, you can just, like, learn improvising as a, like, as a skill itself. Like, I didn't even know that was, like, possible. Mm-hmm. So I was like, damn. And I remember, like, taking this class and, like, boom, like, there I was. I mean, I think that's necessary, like, to, like, move away from form in order to learn how to improvise. Maybe now, like, I see it sort of coming back. I remember telling some friends that I was, like, dancing, and they're like, oh, that's nice. Like, that's cute. Like, you're fucking old. Like, that's cute that you're doing that. You know what I mean? Like,
were, like, they dancer friends or
no,
non-dancer
they're, like,
friends?
Like, university friends. Okay. And they just, like, you know, like, the, it's cute. Like, this is what I mean about the,
yeah, I,
like,
guess dance has that kind of timeline where people kind of train themselves
in the
to a
West.
Certain point. And if you, yeah, if you're, yeah, no longer, yeah, viable to be, yeah, a professional because your body,
yeah,
or your,
yeah,
style or whatever, yeah, then you don't do it anymore.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. All those things.
Right. I thought it was interesting that you brought up that you have a kind of particular ability with improvisation. Is that a thing that you see that carries over towards poetry?
In that sense, they're the exact same thing. Like, I feel like my, like, structured improvisation is what I do in both forms. The constraints will be different, but I have a way of working that I apply to both forms that I like and that works for me.
What's your way of working?
Like, discovering the structure, like, a forward improvisation, and then doing it. I think, like, writing, poetry, I don't know, art is just, like, a process of, like, self-tutelage. You do something spontaneous, you keep doing it, and then you find things that you like, and then you create a system to sort of, like, explore that, and then you just go off with that system.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I like to work that way.
Thank you. Your new book's called I Have to Live, and it's divided into 7 sections. What do those sections mean to you?
It's like music or something. Like, it's like it's a product of rhythm. Like, the other way in which I feel like the practices are one is like that I'm a rhythm artist. There's a rhythm within the line. There's a rhythm happening, like, visually. There's also a rhythm in terms of the tone of the poems and also the sound of the poems, the material. Like, there's, like, so many types of rhythm that you're simultaneously accounting for. It's so complicated, I think, that I don't know, maybe there are people who do it with their head, but I think something that complicated has to be done with your body. If you can hear it, then you can hear it. You know, like if you can hear the song, then you can hear the song, and then you can have ideas about how the song is going. And then the center section is named, and the other ones aren't.
What's the center section named?
Rat versus Lamb.
Okay.
Yeah. That was like one big notebook in one period of time, and I worked on it, and then I like killed it. I like over-edited it, and it was like dead, and I just accepted it was dead. And then somehow I was like looking for something else in my Google Drive, and I saw an old version of it. And I was like, oh no, it had life. Like, you killed it, but it had life. So I made myself do it all over again. I made myself transcribe it like brand new from the notebook. And I was like a lot more gentle with it the second time around.
Because you knew it could die.
Yeah, I knew it could die. So I was like, this time, like, let it live. Like, let it live.
Do you have like a particular passage or part of that that you...
Rat versus Lamb?
Yeah, that you could read. I'm wondering if we can get into some reading of things.
Sure.
If you're into that.
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm going to drink some water. I decided that I was a planet and I was a planet. I had to. I decided that I was a planet and I am. I want to love. I see old women who live. They know something. It's true, I've suffered the delusion that I am unlamb-like, but oh my gosh, that's crazy. Though it doesn't matter where I sit and that I'm fucking crazy, God gave it to me, I have to live. It doesn't matter where I sit and that I'm fucking crunchy, I have to be fibrous so as not to be consumed. I have to fucking live. I can live in the world with the people. I can live in the world with the people if they understand that all a poet is some bitch who thinks she's better and feels sort of bad about it, but not really that bad, more like feels bad for feeling bad at all. Also, I need a lot of money, so I could have a lot of money. That's why I need it. I need a lot of money so I can have it. Because I need to have money.
Okay, can I just say that I was like in tears.
Aww.
When you were talking about becoming fibrous. Aww. That was really beautiful.
That's kind of the title poem, secretly.
Okay.
Well. Yeah. But again, because I killed the poem and it got revitalized like a year and a half later, I don't think the title came in the beginning. I think the title came when it was reborn, when the poem was reborn.
Oh.
Yeah. In earlier drafts of it, when I say I decided that I was a planet and I was a planet, I had felt like I was being a moon, that I was like orbiting around others. And I had to make the decision to be my own fucking planet, or fuck it, my own star. So there's this like a switch that poem sort of announces in the possibility. I think maybe there are different registers of like standing up, of like lifting one's head and like putting one's shoulders back and relaxing one's shoulders and holding one's chest out and like being erect but relaxed and being strong in the core. Like, I think in this book, it's sort of like standing up. You know, it's like me standing up and be like, oh, it's like, look at what I can do if I'm standing up, you know?
It's interesting that you explain like the words using like a physical or bodily like analogy.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I really liked about your book, Aisha, is it's not just a book of standalone poems. There's this way in which the arrangement of things really matters. So I'm thinking specifically about this one part on page 33. There's this poem about through the experience of dancing, how you experienced a moment of ecstasy.
Yeah.
And then immediately following that, there's a few poems about going to work and, you know, shredding documents and scanning patient charts. To me, I had a realization kind of about like the book being about the experience of like living.
Mm, yeah.
In that juxtaposition, in that ordering.
Yeah.
And I'm
yeah.
wondering if you could read those too.
Yeah, I'd love to. Ruth taught me MG's dance, in which one imagines herself held by a giant blue woman named Eureka, the performance of which begets the knowledge that I'd been dancing as if alone, an axial dance, rotating on a center inside myself like a stick or a stalk, but with Eureka behind me, the axis was everywhere, which made me think of my mom. So I blazed, and then shaking upward from the floor to my crown felt generations of pain. And then an image of my mother laughing hard and bright quizzed me, and from my feet again to, this time, my halo, generations of joy waves pulsed, and a door swung open in the center of my chest, revealing a giant passage for of love. I can, could now, take it. That was June. Yeah, I mean, I'd been working so hard on my heart chakra, and my friend came over and taught me a dance, and then I got really stoned, and I mean, the poem tells the story, but fucking felt it open, actually. And I was surprised because, like, despite the fact that I was working on it, I didn't think that it opening would feel like a thing opening. Never occurred to me that it would manifest so kind of like literally as like a space.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause it's almost used as like a way to make fun of, like, I feel like there are caricatures of new agey spiritualism
yeah.
that are like about opening a door.
Yes. Yes.
Know, soft
yes.
voice.
Yes. Yes. And I'm interested in like experiential knowledge, like things that I experience myself. Like that for me is the juice. And the process of like exploring the full extent of my anger and resentment for my mother to a place I'd never allowed myself. I love her so dearly and feel very protective of her. And so I'd never permitted myself to unleash the anger that I felt about some aspects of my childhood and now. And so in letting myself do that, it switched. Like when I went deep into how like rageful I was, all of a sudden it was like, wait a minute. Okay. If this is true, this anger is real and just. However, if I understand, if I know that she loves me and I do, then how do I account for what happened and also her love? If not by understanding that she wasn't capable of anything else. And then if I take that as a fact, then how do I understand that? I ended up thinking about, okay, well, what, how does one have to be, or like, how does one think, or how was one raised in order to feel insecure in these ways to da 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 da? Like the emotional portrait of my mother, if I do the empathetic work of like understanding how one arrives that way, how could I not feel compassion? Oh my God. Like, so then I just felt the space that she came from, and then the space that my grandmother and grandfather must have come from in order to have created that space. And then it just kept going back and back and back. And at that point, it just like, it was like a trauma wave, like that went throughout my entire body. And it was like, oh, holy shit. Like, this doesn't begin with her. Obviously, it doesn't begin with her. Like, anybody can talk about intergenerational trauma, but like, I felt it. I fucking felt it. And then I felt, you know, thank God, I felt the yin. Like, I felt the joy that has sustained us, like, for generations, that allows me to be here. And in terms of my recent ancestral history, when I consider the fact that, and especially I think about women, because I'm a woman, but when I think about enslavement and rape and physical abuse and the kinds of conditions that my ancestors recently have endured, and I think about the fact that I'm a singing dancer, and I think that I have to honor, I have to honor I have to honor them. Like, I don't know, I think I live like a pretty luxurious life. Like, it's not easy, but I sing and I dance. And I sing my song and I dance. And I'm able to do that because of these people. You know? And it's a duty. Like, if I can, I have to. Like, I have to sing. Because I can. So, whoa, you got me to cry, dude. Fuck.
Do you need a tissue?
Gong. Oh my God. Yeah, it's like, it's deep. It's deep. It's really deep. It's really deep. They are very happy. They're all very happy to see me laughing and smiling and singing. They're like, yes. You know,
we got to this point.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. I think they feel like, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Aisha, the one thing I wanted you to read really quickly is the poem on the next page.
Yes. And 34.
Yeah.
I love that one. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. I can't believe I agreed to go to work today. That was so dumb of me. I hate money and I hate sitting down.
That was Aisha Sasha John, who is Aisha and not the idea of Aisha. Her new book of poetry is called I Have to Live. You also heard from Darcy Spidle, who goes by the moniker Chick White, but it's not spelt like white chick in reverse. Chick White's going on tour with his album Malform, with shows in Halifax, Montreal, Ottawa, Kingston, and Toronto. And if you want to know what his blood looks like, you should go to one of them. You also heard the song Tired Ariadne by Old Girl. You can find links to their tour dates and their reviews and their Tumblrs at canadalandshow.com/imp. The Imposter is produced by Kevin Sexton with assistance from Ali Graham, and our theme music is by Nathan Burley. Follow us on Twitter at Impster, that's I-M-P-S-T-R, and you can follow me at Aliyah Pabani. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand. If you like what we do, tell your people about it. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.